This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Democratic presidential challenger Joe Biden is urging patience as the vote counts continue in key states, while U.S. President Trump insists that he's being cheated by Democrats. We get more from AP correspondent Sagar Magani.
Biden is in a commanding position and stands on the cusp of capturing the 270 electoral votes needed to win.
We are absolutely confident that Joe Biden will be the next president of the United States.
But Biden campaign chief Jen O'Malley Dillon is joining him and urging supporters to be calm as the count continues. The president says the count should stop. He's showing no signs of giving up, baselessly alleging electoral fraud as his campaign mounts legal efforts in several battlegrounds. Sagar Magani, Washington.
And the Trump campaign has dropped a bid to stop the count of mail ballots in Las Vegas. AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
The Trump campaign and Nevada Republicans have ended an effort to stop the count of mail ballots in Las Vegas. A document has been submitted to the state Supreme Court saying a settlement has been reached, requiring Clark County election officials to supply additional observation access at a ballot processing facility in Las Vegas. On Election Day, the state Supreme Court declined to stop the count based on an appeal of a state judge's decision not to stop processing mail ballots in Las Vegas and surrounding Clark County. But Trump campaign representatives said they intend to file another complaint in U.S. District Court in Las Vegas to try to stop what they say are improper votes. I'm Mike Gracia.
Days after Election Day, control of the U.S. Senate is still hanging in the balance with a few races still undecided. Republicans trounced Democratic challengers in crucial states on election night, but the GOP failed to lock down the seats needed to retain the majority. One race in Georgia is headed to a January 5th runoff, and contests in Georgia, North Carolina, and Alaska have not been decided. This is VOA News. French President Emmanuel Macron said Thursday that France is reinforcing its border controls after a series of attacks that hit the country in recent weeks. Macron said the number of police and troops in charge of border controls will double from 2,400 now to 4,800. They will focus on fighting illegal immigrants and smuggling activities, he said during a visit to a frontier post at the border with Spain. Macron notably referred to the Islamic extremist attack at the Notre Dame Basilica at the city of Nice that killed three people last week. Drug maker AstraZeneca says it is ramping up production of its coronavirus vaccine candidate with hopes of getting approval by the end of the year. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
AstraZeneca's CEO says they're optimistic the vaccine they're developing with Britain's Oxford University will get clearance for use by year's end. So they're getting ready to supply hundreds of millions of doses by January. He says once they get the green light, the vials will be ready for global distribution. The head of Britain's vaccine task force says AstraZeneca's and Pfizer's vaccines are the most advanced candidates. The world's been anxiously awaiting a coronavirus vaccine to help ease some of the health and economic burdens of the rapidly spreading virus. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Greece announced nationwide lockdown Thursday in the hopes of stemming a rising tide of patients before its hospitals come under unbearable pressure. And the Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis said that he acted before infection rates reached the level seen in many neighboring countries because after years of financial crises that have damaged its health system, it couldn't afford to wait as long to impose restrictions as others had. Before the outbreak, Greece had one of the lowest rates of intensive care beds per capita in Europe. It has since doubled the number. Countries across Europe have imposed tighter restrictions in recent days, but some experts felt those measures were too slow in coming. Britain's own lockdown kicked in Thursday, shuttering restaurants, hairdressers, and clothing stores until at least December 2nd. The lockdown decision was an about-face for the government, which had earlier advocated a targeted regional response to the pandemic. A new study says how we grow, eat, and waste food is a big climate change problem that may keep the world from reaching its temperature-limiting goals, but we do not all have to go vegan, as many have suggested. There is a study calculated just how helpful five general ways to fix the world's food system would be in reducing emissions of heat-trapping gases. And while giving up meat is a big fix, scientists concede most people won't do it. And researchers say if the world does partial fixes on diet, portions, food production methods, food waste, and crop yields, it can get the job done. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America, James Batty in Washington. Today is Friday, November 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi's president demands the dismissal of the school exams board after exams leakage.
Whatever the motives, this is clearly a deliberate act occasioned by elements of criminality, impunity, and negligence that cannot be allowed to continue.
A new book examines jihadist actors in the Sahel region. South Africans react to the U.S. election. And a rights group criticizes Ugandan security forces for excessive force against civilians.
The elections in Uganda have been characteristic of such brutal attacks on journalists who are supposed to be the messengers. So we are calling on the Electoral Commission to assert its powers and come out strongly against acts that are meted out on journalists that are doing their professional work.
And Northern Nigerian girls fight to remain in school amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malawi's president, Lazarus Chakwera, has called for the dismissal of the National Examination Board after end-of-year school exams were leaked on social media. The leak forced the cancellation of national exams and led to clashes earlier this week between angry students and police who used tear gas to disperse the protest. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
In a national address Thursday, Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera said the top managers of the examinations board should be fired for allowing the tests to be leaked. He spoke a day after the Minister of Education cancelled the Malawi Schools Certificate Examinations, or MSCE, which started October 27. The MSCE are final examinations for learners in Malawi's secondary schools, which prepares them for the next level of their education. President Chakwera said the examination leakage proved the incompetence of the Malawi National Examination Board, which administers the exams.
To have several secondary school exam papers leaked and the education of hundreds of thousands of students thrown off course is simply unacceptable. Whatever the motives, this is clearly a deliberate act occasioned by elements of criminality, impunity, and negligence that cannot be allowed to continue.
Police arrested 38 students and three teachers Tuesday from various secondary schools in connection with the leakage of six examination papers that were shared through social media. The executive director of the examinations board, Gerard Chiwunda, told a news conference Wednesday the leakage might have originated from his office and the matter was being investigated.
Even as we speak now, examinations for Geography 1 and Geography 2 have not moved from the district center point to the additional centers in that district. They have not. Those were going to be moved on Saturday or Sunday. So if that examination has leaked, then where else are people going to think of that? It is money.
President Chakwera announced several measures aimed at clearing up the mess. These include a one-week deadline for the Minister of Education to identify and discipline people who allowed the leakage to happen.
I'm therefore giving the Malawi National Examination Board until the end of this month to remove the top management of MANEB on account of this gross failure and replace it with a new team that will conduct the most credible examinations that Malawi has ever had, which must be done no later than January.
Education expert Steve Sharam says although he welcomes the measures making the students wait for a new exam after months of COVID-19 closures, sounds unfair.
They have already spent 5 months of school closures. We know what happened. Some students got pregnant, some got married, and then when schools resumed, at least it was a big relief because we are going to at least begin the process of returning to normality. And then this happens again. So we risk having those unfortunate incidents all over again.
Shara feels the government should re-administer the examinations within days or weeks by just replacing the leaked papers rather than punishing the students for the crime they did not commit. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
The Human Rights Network of Ugandan Journalists has condemned what it says is the continued use of excessive force by the country's security institutions against unarmed civilians. The group is also calling on President Yoweri Museveni to demand an end to violence against civilians by state security forces. The group's remarks come after journalist Moses Bwayo was shot in the face this week by police using a rubber bullet while he was working. The Human Rights Network for Ugandan Journalists is calling for an independent inquiry into the incident. Supporters of the ruling NRM party are expressing support for the police for maintaining law and order. Robert Sempala is the executive director for the Human Rights Network for Ugandan Journalists. He tells viewers Peter Clotty that the use of excessive force by the police against unarmed civilians must stop.
The election in Uganda have been characteristic of such brutal attacks on journalists who are supposed to be the messengers. In Uganda, we're having a very unique election where the Electoral Commission said we have a scientific campaign and that the media will be the main campaign platform. So we would expect that the media is accorded fair treatment and given a lot of safety and protection by the security forces. But from what we are witnessing now, the media seems to be equally targeted. And to us, this is the ugly face of political intolerance, where security forces think that media must not cover those political opponents to the incumbent, who's the president of Uganda. And as such, they look at journalists as political opponents, which is extremely unfortunate at this point. So we are calling on the Electoral Commission to assert its powers and come out strongly against acts that are meted out on journalists that are doing their professional work.
Some Ugandans I hear are calling for an independent investigation into the attack on the journalist Moses, because they fear the journalist could have lost his eye or perhaps his life. What do you say to that?
I entirely agree and associate myself with all efforts that are geared towards holding the respective security officers to account, because use of excessive force is also a breach of principles and guidelines of the elections. So we eagerly waiting to see what the security forces can do, but that is one of the first steps to show indication that they are going to investigate into this matter. If not, certainly we as organizations that support press freedom and journalist rights will have to come up with a position, and that at this point might have to be a very drastic one. Otherwise, this is the ugly face of attacks on journalists, and is a very big affront on press freedom in the country where we are at.
Some Ugandans, on the other hand, are also saying that they don't see the government, or for that matter, the president, demanding an investigation into what happened, because several people have been attacked by the security forces in Uganda. Demands have been made for investigation. Nothing like that have happened because the government remains silent in such instances. How do you react to that?
Yes, we have seen so many ugly attacks on especially political opponents of the president. And at some point, the president came out and said, yes, he was very happy with how forces had treated the political opponent, Bobi Wine, and that they treated him well. And that was to the utter shock of many Ugandans, because we thought that the president was going to rise up on a matter of gross indiscipline and misuse of power by the security forces. But the fact that he came out and congratulated them really points to a fact that there is a lot of impunity that is being entrenched and in the full watch of those that are in political offices. So we really need to take on these forces, especially through dragging the individuals to court to answer on an individual basis.
Robert Sempala is the executive director of the Human Rights Network for Ugandan Journalists. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Kampala.
A new book entitled Jihadists of North Africa in the Sahel looks at jihadist actors in the Sahel as politicians. Author Alex Thorsten spoke to Ricky Stryak about the shifting dynamics of the ongoing conflict in Mali and the inner political workings of violent groups in the region.
Regardless of where jihadists come from, so for example, if they're coming from Algeria to northern Mali, they come into places or they're from places and they have roles that go beyond just indoctrinating people or recruiting people in a military sense or staging attacks, that basically if they stay in a place for any length of time, they're surrounded by relationships, and that some of those relationships are going to be pure support, right? People they recruit. And some of those relationships are going to be pure antagonism, people they fight. But a lot of the relationships are going to be complicated, and that's where the politics comes in, that they're going to have to negotiate and compromise and strategize and form coalitions, and they may find that they have, you know, limited interest in common with some people, and then they have a limited political coalition or relationship with those people. So I think... And that doesn't mean, none of that is to say that they don't believe in their ideologies, but I think that people can be highly ideological, but also highly shrewd at the same time.
We talk about politics in this way, but isn't that the how they, quote, govern the people who where they are? Isn't that essentially politics? And kind of what does that look like in places like, I mean, for instance, let me ask northern Mali.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, whenever they take control of territory or even when they just exercise sway, I mean, they have to make decisions. And one of the surest signs that this is political is that they disagree with one another. They have constant political decisions to make. And those are just, yeah, heightened when they take over territory.
What is an outlook in which the people who are not, quote, jihadists, but who are living in these areas are able to thrive in a way that gives them, you know, a sense of safety, you know, access to basic services?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the jihadist presence, I think that, first of all, you know, the way that people might align with jihadists are not necessarily all based on ideology. And in 2012, for example, the rebellion in northern Mali had started with a separatist nationalist movement wanting to create, you know, or saying that they wanted to create an independent state called Azawad. There have been then, you know, credible reports from Human Rights Watch, from other places, that they behaved quite badly when they came into places, that they, you know, raped women, that they, you know, looted and so forth. And the jihadists also were better organized and militarily superior after a while. And so they could offer, you know, forms of governance, I guess, for lack of a better word, or at least a sense of temporary law and order that other factions couldn't.
That was Alex Thorsten, author of a new book entitled Jihadists of North Africa and the Sahel. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Ohio. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, November 6th. As Americans watch the U.S. presidential election, so too does the world. In South Africa, the continent's most mature democracy, pundits and partisans alike are glued to the news because they say whether you live in Duluth, Minnesota, or Durban, South Africa, the U.S. election matters to all. Viewers Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
It was nearly 1 a.m. in Wilmington, Delaware, when journalist Stephen Frutus interrupted his live radio show with some breaking news. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden was speaking to the nation after a long, tense election day.
Good afternoon to you, as I say, a special edition of Newsfeed this afternoon because of the U.S. presidential elections. Expecting that press.
Here's why this is unusual. Frutus hosts radio and TV shows on the other side of the planet, in South Africa. But even here, the U.S. election is inescapable. Election news dominates front pages from Nigeria to Kenya to South Africa, with detailed coverage of developments from strange-sounding foreign lands like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Arizona. This election, Frutus explained, is the world's business.
Myself and so many other people in South Africa are really, in a way, obsessed with the American elections. We kind of are anyway, because it's, you know, the oldest democracy in the world. People used to look up to America. In this case, because of the sort of Trump effect, because of the consequence of it, partly because of what Trump has said about our continent, which is not very nice, I found myself just obsessed by it, checking American news websites, you know, sort of almost living a slightly different life.
The U.S. consulate estimates that as many as 30,000 Americans live in the country. About 780 are registered members of Democrats Abroad, including Florida voter Anita Vorlacek. There's no known South African chapter of their counterpart, Republicans Overseas. In fact, the organization has no presence at all in sub-Saharan Africa. Vorlacek, a 27-year-old graduate student, voted in Charlotte County, where Trump won easily, and says she's been following the results nervously. She was already awake when Trump declared himself the winner in the early hours of Wednesday morning, and she was not amused.
So I think he's trying to instill doubt in people. He's trying to instill fear in people, and that's dangerous. And that's, I think no matter who gets elected, the biggest challenge that's going to be moving forward is trying to unite and bring all Americans together, because as we can see in those results, we are very divided.
South African political analyst Ralph Matega has also been rising early and going to bed late so he can watch the election results unfold across the seven-hour time difference.
Yeah, well, American election has got implications on Africa and on global stability. I mean, during Trump's regime, things got bad. Global relations were at their worst. So it also affects trade as well. As African countries, we should be concerned. I mean, we have trade relations with the USA. So American elections have got very, very deep implications.
Curtis says he wasn't surprised by much of the events, including the Trump campaign's move to file lawsuits in the battleground states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Georgia. But he said he was a little taken aback by just how close the results have been.
I think a lot of South Africans thought that this would be, in a way, a Democratic correction, that Trump would be sort of trounced from the White House, that the Republicans would sort of be thrown out of the Senate. And that hasn't happened, and I think that's really surprised a lot of South Africans. I think frustrated them to an extent as well.
Frustration, impatience, disappointment, hope, and some fear and anger. In many ways, as the U.S. democratic process continues, it is increasingly clear Africa and the U.S. aren't so far apart after all. Anita Palafoe News, Johannesburg.
Young girls in Nigeria's north are struggling to remain in school during the COVID-19 pandemic, and aid groups say many face the risk of child marriage. Ifeok Itang reports from Kano.
15-year-old Umi Ali leads a team of four other girls in a 4x4 phone repair workshop in Kausani, Kano. There is no furniture, and they all work on the ground with their legs in cross positions. Dressed in hijabs, these young girls make stipends by replacing faulty phone parts, charging them, and then transferring media files for customers for a fee. Ali says she dropped out of school 4 months ago after she got married, but she's glad she can still work here. I'm happy now that I am in the aspect of repairing phones, she says. I could not repair phones. Now I can. I can also operate laptops and do many other things, Ali says. I'm thankful. In this part of Nigeria, 68% of girls are married before their 18th birthday. With no education, these women aspire only to be wives and mothers, while their male peers go further in their careers, says Amina Hanga, the executive secretary of the Isawale Empowerment Initiative. The nonprofit and non-governmental organization creates safe spaces where young girls learn to read, write, and develop vocational skills, including those typically regarded as male-oriented.
The man is supposed to provide, the man is supposed to be to do everything, whereas the woman is just to be the wife and have children. Then at one point, there was also religion was brought into it, that because the majority here are Muslims, and they were using, it was a misperception or misconception about what religion says, because actually Islam says, seek for education no matter where it takes you, and it did not say male or female, it said seek, meaning that both male and female should seek for education.
The Ford Foundation sponsors the empowerment program Pathway to Choice, run by Hanga and other mentors. It has empowered more than 200 girls across several communities. 76% of girls who participated in the program returned to formal schooling This includes Robbie Salisu, who says all the girls in her family never get beyond a primary education. Honestly, at home, they will not allow us to continue school because all my siblings didn't finish school, Salisu says. She says once you dream of going to school, they will just marry you out. The Nigeria federal government passed the Child Rights Act 2003 that prohibits the marriage and betrothal of children below the age of 18. But 11 states in northern Nigeria have not yet enforced it at the state level. Hanga says the law needs to be enforced in order to create lasting change.
Having laws in place like the Child Rights Act, the Violence Against Persons Prohibition Act, domesticated, so having them domesticated in the states, and various other policies would also help in ensuring that girls get an education.
The United Nations estimates the coronavirus pandemic has brought about an additional 13 million child brides as a result of the economic strain brought on poor families. But despite the effects of the pandemic, girls like Sally Sue are fighting to be self-sufficient. I want to grow and help my parents, she says. I don't want to be a burden on my parents or on my husband. So when I have a need, I'll just take my money to meet it, she says. I'm happy to return to school because it is great progress. Ifeok Etan for VOA News, Kano, Nigeria.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the Confederation of African Football CAF Champions League, where Zamalek left it late before beating Raja Club Athletic 3-1 and 4-1 on aggregate at the Cairo International Stadium to progress into the Total CAF Champions League final. The Egyptian Giants booked a historic Cairo Derby date against rivals Al-Hali in the final set for the Burj Al Arab Stadium in Alexandria on November the 27th. This year's final will be the first Champions League final between clubs from the same country. Zamalek will be making their first final since 2016 when they lost to Mamelodi Sundowns, and now in search for a sixth Champions League crown. The South African Football Association and the Sao Tome Football Federation have officially signed a memorandum of understanding, agreeing that South Africa will host the two Cameroon 2021 African Cup of Nations qualifiers on the 13th and 16th of November 2020. The two countries mutually agreed that due to the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, it was in the best interest of the two countries that they do everything in their power to save guard the interests of players and officials. Therefore, both parties agreed that the first and return leg matches will all be played in South Africa. Staying with football news, Liverpool star Mohamed Salah has expressed his delight after equaling Steven Gerrard's goal-scoring record in the UEFA Champions League. The Reds grabbed a huge away win on Tuesday this week after defeating Atlanta 5-0 in the UEFA Champions League group stages. Salah's goal against Atlanta, his 21st for Liverpool in the UEFA Champions League, moved the Egyptian level with Steven Gerrard as Liverpool's all-time leading Champions League goal scorer. The Ghana Football Association will this weekend organize the Technical Integrity and Competition Management System training for referees and assistant referees selected for the Ghana Premier League. The training programs will cover laws of the game, Amendment 2021, FIFA Law 12, how to handle handball situations, FIFA Law 11, positioning and reading of the game, and practical training, integrated training with players. The referees will also be taking voting through the use of the new communication gadget purchased to be used during the Ghana Premier League season to enhance their output on the field. In cycling news, Rwanda Cycling Federation has named a 9-rider roster to start training ahead of the 2021 Grand Prix Chantel Biya race in Cameroon this November. The 9 elite Rwanda riders began their residential camp for intensive preparations on Wednesday. The race is scheduled for November 18th to the 22nd. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, November 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson Omale, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Botte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.